The Sunday Papers on Off the Ball.
Brought to you by Avantcard Reward Plus Credit Card. Powered by MasterCard. Straight up better than your current credit card. Avantcard DAC is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland.
This is the Sunday Papers slot here on Off the Ball. We are coming to you live on all our social channels as well as on the radio, so you'll be able to stream it on Facebook and Twitter and Periscope and wherever you stream your social media, and on offtheball.com as well is where you'll get us. We're joined in studio by Jack Anderson, who is a professor of sports law at the University of Melbourne and back home for a couple of weeks, I presume, or months even?
No, just a few weeks, unfortunately. A few weeks.
Good, okay. Yeah. And we have Aidan O'Hara as well, who is deputy group head of sport with the Independent Group. And has been working on the Sunday Independent this week?
Yes. Yeah.
We will eviscerate you page by page.
Please do.
Why did you do this, Aidan? Why made you think this part would work? All that kind of stuff coming up. I'll run you through headlines back pages very quickly then. Lost Pog. This is Paul Pogba, 26. He's on quite a few of the back pages. It seems basically Manchester United aren't too sure if Paul Pogba is going to turn up to catch the flight to Australia today. They're off on their pre-season tour around Australia, Singapore and China. 18-day trip. The word is not so clear on whether or not Pogba is going to turn up. So he's made quite a few of the back pages. And then Route 66 for Charvin. This is Cormac Charvin, who along with Robin Dawson are leading the Irish hopes in Lynch, but probably a bit too far back realistically. That's the back page of the Mirror. We have the Sunday Independent here. And it's Mayo, as has been the case for the last couple of weeks, to be honest, on the front pages in many cases. Mayo roller coaster keeps on rolling. Joe Brawley here. Watching Mayo play football is like watching Amir Khan boxing. The knockout could come at any moment. And just talks about how damn exciting it is to follow Mayo at the moment. And Killarney next Sunday is where the sat-nav is set for. And Dawson flies the home flag as Rock rolls with superb 60. That's Dermot Galease on Robert Rock's 60 yesterday in La Hinch. Sunday World then, D-Day for Pog. United furious at France star's public bid for exit. Similar theme to the last story. Then Mayo, bring it on. A picture here of Donald Vaughan just after he'd punted the bouncing ball over the bar. You might remember that point yesterday, fist in the air. Mayo keep All-Ireland dream alive after Horan's men survive another scare in Limerick to set up Super 8's trip to Kerry. That's Philip Lanigan at the Gaelic grounds. Sports star then, Mega Books Maguire, 250k a week United deal. So Manchester United hoping to make Harry Maguire their third highest paid player as they try and grab him from Leicester for 90 million, a salary of 250k sterling a week is on offer for Maguire if he wants to go there. Another Pogba headline, spot the Pog. Manchester United sweating on Paul Pogba returning for today's flight to Australia. It's a bizarre story, really, that they're not sure if he's going to make the flight or not. Sunday Times, Mayo and Galway, it's Aidan O'Shea in the air trying to catch the ball yesterday. Next up, Kerry. Mayo sing tribesmen to set up Super 8's clash in Killarney. And then Jonathan Northcroft here on the Pogba situation. So it's Juventus to offer 130 million sterling for Pogba. They do have money at the moment, Juventus, after splashing out over 116 million euro on Ronaldo last year and paying him 31 million euro in salary. So Juventus are thought to be preparing, writes Northcroft, a 130 million euro bid for Paul Pogba. Again, references the fact that Manchester United expect Pogba, says Northcroft, to be on their tour of Australia and the Far East and join up with the rest of the squad. He says the plane heads for Perth, Australia tomorrow. So there's a bit of confusion across the papers as to when that flight goes. But he's confident, Northcroft, that Manchester United are confident Pogba will show up. Although Mino Raiola has been saying that he wants away, and it seems Juventus will offer 130 million, which might be the worst thing in the world considering United bought him for 100 million. Be 30 million profit on a player that's not quite working out. And Sun Sport, Pogba D-Day, Man United Chiefs fear star won't show for flight to Oz. And Mayo again are beneath that. Horan's happy to survive. That Pogba story is pretty extraordinary, isn't it? At what point do you close the boarding for the flight? Just hang on five more minutes, he'll be here any minute.
It sounds like an episode of Friends, you know, where Ross and Rachel are, you know, after a wedding or something like that, and they're trying to wait on the flight, and I think eventually the United flight will take off and Pogba will be left there. But it's just English football in July, it's very hard to like sometimes, with sagas and things like that. It'll happen eventually. He'll go eventually because he wants to go. That's just the way it works these days. It's just a question of how much. And then you've Harry Maguire, you know, 250,000 going to, it just keeps on stacking and stacking and stacking, you know.
Isn't it terrible that you're now showing your age with a Friends reference?
Yes, I know.
Any Seinfeld ones for us there?
No, not quite. We'd probably do Frasier if you needed to, but anything after that, I'd be struggling.
So, hey, let's start with Mayo then, the Mayo roller coaster. Page one, Joe Brawley's writing about it on page one for the Sunday Independent and just talking about the thrills and spills of following Mayo.
Yeah, I mean, the Amir Khan reference at the start, he then goes on to talk about the fans, the Mayo fans must feel similarly to the way Amir Khan's family must feel, like after watching him win six rounds and knowing that in the seventh he could get knocked out, that kind of feeling of, you know, against Armagh, they dominated and they nearly, not quite threw it away, it'd be too strong to say they nearly threw it away, but they were nearly hauled in again last night. They were the better team for the vast majority of the game, and you know, we're nearly logged in or reeled in. He writes, like, when they were 8 up, 24 minutes, 6 up, 35 minutes, 51 minutes, 61 minutes, and 68 minutes, and 8 up, 45 minutes, they showed no composure again. With 8 minutes to go, James Horan had his head in his hands, and the Mayo fans were experiencing the agony in the garden again. Mm. But at the end of it, which is why. This is why Mayo continues to be the most important team in Gaelic football, and sat now for Killarney. Just the enjoyment of them. They're one of those teams you might not necessarily support them, but you want to watch them. Always want to watch them, unlike many other teams, you would always want to watch them.
Including Galway. It's a relief to see Galway gone, he writes. Galway teams should not play like Fermanagh, and this was a team and a manager in its death throes. They played as we knew they would, with zero imagination. They soloed and hand-passed and ran up blind alleys, and by the 46th minute, not a single Galway forward had scored from play, which was a damning statistic yesterday throughout the game. He does write, the downside of Mayo's huge entertainment value is that they find it quite impossible to control a game. So that when they were 7 points up after 18 minutes, nobody was saying this game is over.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, what's impressive about this piece too is how it must have been delivered quite late, because the match was quite late as well. And it's very, you know, well-written and evocative piece. And he has some, you know, usual kind of brawly quips in it. One of the things he says is, another top-class exhibition of goalkeeping from Clark, who runs like a dressage horse but doesn't put a foot wrong. And it's those kind of pictures that he paints that are tremendous. So yeah, so and it's true. I mean, it's fantastic for the GAA, the football championship, that Mayo are still in it, you know. I mean, that is, it's hugely important. This team has so many stories around it. And of course then he cannot avoid having to dig at Galway, because I think he has this thing for Cora Finn and Cora Finn's style of play as well, so that comes out as well. But such a it's the barrister getting the late minute brief and yet presenting beautifully in court, and it's a bit like that on the front page of the Sunday Independent today.
And Aidan, you'd know better than most, it's not an easy thing to do on the whistle under massive time pressure. You're probably ringing him saying, where is it?
That tends to be like kind of clicking your fingers at a waiter, not just with Joe, with every reporter. Most reporters, if you ring them and ask them where their copy is, the first response is, well, if you got off the phone, I'd be able to file it a bit quicker. That's usually the first response. But
it's a fair response.
It is a fair response, absolutely it is. But and it wouldn't be just, like, obviously Joe has done this piece, but across the different papers, there's different deadlines across the day. So, you know, you have the early matches, which will be going for first editions, then you have the later matches, and they're quite tight on deadlines. So producing the pieces, particularly the coloury commentary type pieces on GAA matches or on your international soccer matches, that's the real skill of a writer, to be able to do those type of 900 word pieces within, you know, 10-15 minutes of the whistle blowing. It's
incredible, really.
It's a great skill. And then you're from the production point of view, then you're flying through it and making sure everything's okay with it, and getting it in the paper and going, you know, like, that's choosing your pictures and all that sort of stuff. But like, it's the complete
spending the next day staring at the typo that's ruined your day.
I hope you haven't spotted one, have you? Because it actually would ruin my day.
No,
that sort of thing would. There's a few mistakes over the years that still get brought up, and a few, you know, that will some of the illicit phone calls from angry readers, mostly if you leave out certain things, but. Yeah. most of the time it's, you know, the yeah, not, nobody wants to have typos or anything like that. You gave me a fright there for a minute.
No, no, yeah, you're safe. Pat Spillane in the Sunday World has a backward glance at last weekend and basically says that Kieran McGeaney was not an overnight success, but he's finding his feet now. Keane O'Neill talks about how he played a great part in the Newbridge or Nowhere mentality last year. However, since then, it's been downhill all the way. And this is certainly a county in need of a fresh voice and a new approach, says Spillane. Though he starts the whole thing by saying, I drive past the Curragh regularly during the summer months and I marvel at the new grandstand there that costs north of 80 million euro. And every time I do, I just think I just enjoy this image.
Yeah.
Every time I do, I am infuriated at what a total waste of money it is, with 30 million euro of the cost funded by taxpayers. This is a building that's rarely used and certainly will never be full, judging by last week's woeful attendance at the Derby. If ever an event didn't deserve the hype, this was it. 1.5 million euro in prize money, 8 horses competing, 5 from the Aidan O'Brien stable, not a horse coming over from England or France. Methinks Dubai Duty Free have been sold a pup, and a very expensive sponsorship pup as well. And then a few lines later, he says, racing rant over, and now it's back to the football. Yeah. 30 million euro is a good old grant for that stadium.
It is. I suppose it's in some ways it's our most important sports industry, though. In terms of the bloodstock trade and what it's worth to the country overall. Mm. You know, we do kind of underestimate that when we talk about sport as a whole. The Curragh, they will be disappointed at the attendance figures for the Derby. There's no question about that. And really, with Sovereign winning, it's effectively the pacemaker won the race, you know, which is disappointing for them as well. But, you know, we're still hugely important and we do subsidise horse racing, you know, to a large extent because we have to, and it's important to us. He admits it's a rant, you know, and as you say, the image of him driving up the whatever it is and passing the thing is a thing. I mean, and the rest of it, then he goes on, Kieran McGeaney is okay, he can stay apparently, but Keane O'Neill can't. So it's a kind of a classic Pat Spillane get to the point pretty quickly.
Get to several points, I think. It's kind of another thing in the piece. It's like, I mean, it flows very well. You can read it almost in his accent, almost. Do you think
he doesn't tease much out. He just, as you said, goes, this is what I think about this. Yeah. He has to go. He can stay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Farewell, Pat.
That's fine. Because even with Kildare, you know, I think they won the minor, Leinster minor again. They're doing quite well underage, you know. And Keane O'Neill is a well-regarded coach. You know, whether he's got enough out of Kildare or not is an issue. But, you know, there are bigger issues there as well. But that's not Pat Spillane's style.
No, it wouldn't be. Nuance, who needs nuance? Let's just punch it out there.
Yeah. There's a market for that. There's definitely a market for that as well. Like, you know, people, I mean, That Colin's been going a long time, and you know he's very successful on RTE and that as well. And that's his style. He makes his points, moves on to the next point, makes that as well. And that's there's a very strong audience for that.
You both liked Ross King in the Mail.
Yeah,
who is Ross King? A lot of people
Ross
might wonder.
Ross King is a leash hurler who suffered a terrible injury in a leash club game. I'm just trying to find exactly where the details are. He had his teeth knocked out in the leash club game, and basically effectively fell out of love with the game for a little while and headed off traveling in Puerto Rico. And a piece by Philip Lanigan in the Mail, and he talks about how he was in Puerto Rico watching leash against Limerick, and you know, actually felt a bit of a need to come back, and Eddie Brennan got in touch with him then, and he came back and he scored a goal then last week in the Joe McDonagh Cup final, which they won. And he talks about how special that was. We had 15 or 20 minutes of leash hurling being on top of the world between lovely leash and seeing Pat Delaney lift the cup. And Paddy, there are moments, maybe moments in 50 years time that I might be able to say I was there, I was on that team. So like, there's a good few little I suppose angled in it, where you talk about the tiered championship would be one where people wouldn't necessarily think of leash hurling being they're not a powerhouse by any stretch, but you know, they had the chance today as well, obviously against Dublin. But you know, the importance on how much the success means to people involved in that, also coming back from, as I said, what was a terrible injury, and rediscovering his love for the game. He also had a football scholarship, a soccer scholarship, and then he switched on to a hurling scholarship in UCD. But it's a very strong piece. The other thing about it is that he's actually playing today, and there's a piece by Michael Foley in the Sunday Times as well, with Turbidity from Clare, and both also playing today. And it's unusual, and it's good to see players who are involved in games today, you know, being able to give interviews in the week of games, you know, telling their story. There's nothing, you know, there's nothing on the dressing room wall that could be put in the dressing room wall from Dublin or from Meath's point of view with the Clare piece. They're just good stories to tell, well told, well written, and gives a little insight into both the player and the team around them, you know.
Mm. Also, the last thing a team or management are doing on the morning of a game is checking the papers.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, the contrast with, say, and I know it's professional, but I live in Melbourne, and the AFL, how they use the players all week to promote the game,
right,
constantly using the current players, is just a marked contrast to, you know, particularly GA, where the embargo settles about 3 weeks in advance, you know, and you just kind of go. And it'll be interesting to see in the future how the GPA deals with that. You know, if you're getting money from the GA trying to promote it indirectly, how that will settle. So that's one thing about that. The second thing is just the general point he makes about, I think, leash of 8 senior hurling clubs, they need everyone playing, and how he really enjoys the Joe McDonagh Cup and how they found their level. And he was saying it's probably slightly different with hurling, because if you meet one of the top teams, you can get a massive walloping. And he says, look, you have to find your own level and develop as you go along. Mm. So that's good on that. There's always things you'd like to see them being helped with. Like, for example, I'd like to see the Joe McDonagh winners getting 4 home games then when they go up to Leinster. You know, those things to help, instead of them being yo-yo, a bit like Carlo. So he speaks about that. And I thought, from my point of view, what was interesting is he spoke about last autumn and the you know, I think his jaw was broken, or at least he had dental issues.
Yeah, thousands of euro of dental work done on him. Yeah.
And that was at the height of, do you remember last autumn, there was a number of club incidents in the GA where we had violence issues. And sometimes with the GA, it comes up every calendar year. You know, there are certain things come up and then we forget about it. Mm. And he just kind of speaks about that. So that's an interesting point. But there's a number of good GA pieces in the Irish Mail, and that's probably the best one. Mm-hmm.
The paragraph here, it just said, sorry, George. And yet the only day in the sun he looked like experiencing this year was in the Caribbean island of Puerto Rico in March. He knows there's nothing to be gained by reliving the trauma of the Laois County final last October, when a butt of a hurley through a face mask left his face a mess. Apart from the fissure in his lip that looked more akin to a knife wound, there was the smashed teeth that required thousands of euro of dental work. When the clip of the incident and the photographs of the damage done went national, the level of genuine shock and outrage stretched beyond local or parish rivalries. Mm. He goes into it a little bit, not too much. He doesn't want to relive it. He says no issue back on the senior team or anything like that. But it's very much a background to the piece, because when you're saying, like, Ross King, it's a name you might have heard of a little while ago. But that's the reason why you might have heard his name is probably because of that incident. And it was a couple of paragraphs, you know, of story that.
Yeah, I was saying to you guys earlier on, to have your teeth smashed out is one of the worst things that could happen to you on a field.
Yeah. And the dental costs that go with it and the recovery and all that. Yeah.
You know, probably never quite feel like your teeth are back the same way again. No.
Yeah.
The mental side of things with that, though, to come back, you know, within a relatively short period of time to get back to the level that he has. And he seems to be flourishing under Eddie Brennan as well. So.
I never saw the incident that was filmed in that county final. I presume the butt of a hurl doesn't make its way through the helmet face guard by accident.
I don't know.
It's a freak accident if it does, but it sounds like it's one of those incidents.
Yeah, and it's a general thing with, because the nature of club championships now that they're kind of August to October, you know, or later, it becomes such an intense period, and we've had incidents like this almost every autumn for the last while, and you wonder, are we going to be looking at similar things, you know, on social media again this autumn?
Well, I find that there's a rhythm to the off-season and the post-All-Ireland inter-county finals to Christmas is almost GAA violence, because these issues crop up when the club matches are so intense.
Yeah.
And then January is players are being burnt out month.
Because they're playing Sigerson,
Fitzgibbon, and all these Mickey Mouse kind of warm-up competitions. And then we get into the league and we forget all that again until about October again.
Exactly. And that's, you know, there's some pieces today about the playing rules as well. And that has its you know, thing in the calendar as well. Mm. But that's just
a, you could do a GAA calendar at the start of the year, yeah, but you know, week one, you know, ridiculousness of preseason competitions. Yeah. Week two, burnout. Week three, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Like yeah, there's
week eight, the league is the league.
Yeah. Yes, the league is the league. Yeah, don't week nine, don't read too much into it. Week 10, the hype. You know, that sort of.
Just one other GAA piece I wanted to mention. I always think Paul Galvin makes a good effort to do something a bit different and give a good insight. And he does that on page two, where he's just talking about GAA physios, and it's not something you give too much thought to, I think. He starts off by remembering watching Paddy Small last week come in to the Leinster final and really looking forward to seeing Paddy Small, because he felt that, you know, down the years he had the potential to be even better than Paul Mannion, but then he was helped off not long afterwards with a hamstring injury. And he goes on to say, it struck me lately that the GAA is in the middle of an injury epidemic going on for so long that it's acquired a normalcy. I thought that was a really good point. Injuries are part of the game, but to what extent are injuries normal? And, you know, he mentions James Horne last week was kind of asked about the number of Mayo injuries, but a lot of them are bangs and knocks and contact injuries, impact injuries, as opposed to muscle injuries. And he said, GAA training is like a contagion. One team starts something, the rest catch on. Early morning sessions, double sessions, the need for a team or a player to hit certain numbers in a game. You know, Dermot O'Connor, he talks about getting 16K last year in Newbridge. That became the new bar to hit.
16 kilometres, just in case, rather than getting 16K, in case people misheard things based on the references a few weeks back.
Yeah. And then he said, in my time with Kerry, we found it difficult to keep physios for more than 2 years, and this brings in subtle complexities for players and management, often a gap in knowledge. The new physio doesn't know your player's injury history or the prehab that you have to do, and there's gaps there. There's no written record, almost. I thought that was a very interesting point, because you don't think about that. And he says, in reality, all these physio positions are non-contract or part-time. How can two physios adequately deal with a training panel of 30 or 35 players? It's inevitable that energy, efficiency and performance will suffer. And that was in broad strokes, the brunt of his piece today. That was a good one. I'd say it is the reality that a huge number of inter-county teams do have just the two physios looking after two players. And there is that element of contagion within training. Well, they're doing double sessions, we'll do double sessions.
Yeah.
You need one size fits all training in professional sport. Geez, in amateur sport where lads are doing different types of days work, you really need it.
Absolutely, because the rest and recuperation isn't there because you're going straight into work. And it's always interesting to hear experts in the area like Niall.
University professors will get a nice day's rest. You know, they go in and sit down and relax all day.
Yeah, thanks for that.
It's more hardworking people we're talking about here.
Yeah, I'll take your point for that, Joe. Thanks very much.
But the guy sitting here at a desk all day drinking coffee.
But it's when you hear people like Niall Moynagh saying, you know, the training to game ratios and, you know, the length of the pre-season for GAA players, you do, and then you focus on they've only got two physios, you know. But it's interesting, some counties, and I think Kerry is like this, that at a central level they have strength and conditioning coaches who are there now, going to be all the time there. So they can plan ahead then for 5 years and bring the minors through and I think that's important as well, right? You know, so you're talking a lot about acute injuries there, but just the general long-term kind of athlete welfare issue is a big one too. Yeah. But it just shows you how big the GAA is becoming, you know, that you need all of this.
I think as well, he writes here as well, which I thought was interesting. 80-minute games are another factor in the muscle injury toll. This is too long for amateur players. Now, you will hear a hell of a lot about how much training that GAA teams are doing. So to write that 80-minute games are too long for amateur players, when you hear that the amateur players are training like professionals a lot, I would see a little bit of a contrast there, or a little bit of a contradiction.
But wouldn't you agree that despite the amateurs saying they are training like professionals, they are not?
No, they're not. But
arguably not anything close.
No, well, it depends on what level of professional you would say. I would think. I mean, I wouldn't class them as, you know, training at the level of, you know, an AFL or a Premier League or, you know, teams like that. You know, League of Ireland levels, and, you know, maybe. I could be wrong there. I could get shot down with that. But, like, I think certainly certain counties would be training at, you know, 4 or 5 times a week, you know, and all the strength and conditioning that goes in. I think the point about the training is the level of amount of pre-season training to matches, the ratio there is crazy. What's going to be interesting with this as well, when he talks about muscle injuries, like, Dublin, for example, haven't really been pushed, as a couple of other counties as well, going into the Super 8s, and they're now going to have 3 games in 4 weeks. which is going to be interesting to see what way they rotate their squads, etc. And some will have the luxury of rotating their squads because they might win the first couple of games, and others won't.
Yeah.
And how, you know, how the team after week four comes out of it before going into the potentially a semi-final and a final, that's going to be very interesting. On, you know, on the back of an article, like, it'd be interesting to read this in again in 4 or 5 weeks' time and just see how many muscle injuries have come from those.
Like, I was interested in his line that there is an injury epidemic, but we've just become so used to it that it's been normalised. Mm. Like, is that the case? You know, and you talk about how we're training and how they are training like professional teams. Even Carl Lacey was in here a couple of weeks ago, and he had spent time over at Arsenal for his diploma in sports management. And he was just comparing Donegal, even at their very best, with Arsenal.
Yeah.
The Arsenal guys are coming in every day, blood test, urine test.
Yeah.
They check your hamstring strength in comparison with your thigh strength to see how's the ratio, balance. How's the balance. You're not training today.
Yeah.
Could you imagine, like, a GAA lads are getting out of the car. Some of them, in reality, have grabbed a roll in the apple green on the way. And it's like, get onto the pitch. And then we're feeling a bit stiff. They don't know why, but sure, we'll run it off and might do a bit of foam rolling later. And you can see how you end up 2 physios, 35 lads, you know?
Yeah, he makes the point as well about players, talking about, you know, player responsibility for this. Yeah, where are we now? Prevention is better than cure, and players have a personal responsibility to present themselves for the training in the best shape possible. Mm. There's a double edge with that, I think, as well, that there's also the if you look at professional soccer players, a lot of the time would say, because they know they've got a game the next week, if they feel a little something in their hamstring, they'll put their hand up and say, take me out now, because they know that, you'll know straight away whether that's a week injury. That's a 1 week injury or a 2 week injury, rather than trying to push through it. I'm not sure within the GAA there's the culture, if you like, of putting your hand up and saying, I'm actually hurt here, and for the benefit of the team, I might be trying to, you know, come out. I'm not sure if that culture is there. I wouldn't be within GAA dressing rooms and things like that.
Quite often, for a start, there's no tomorrow in GAA.
No,
there isn't.
If you're a Meath player today or a Clare player, that hamstring is staying out. We're going for it.
And they're learning all the time. You know, if you look at the hurling round robin, you know, the third game was always the one, you know, and John Kiley famously against Tip rested some Limerick players and got a bit of, you know, comeback from that. So they're learning, you know, so they're adapting all the time. But it's something, and the GAA has quite a good medical and player welfare committee. They're quite good on this. But, and it's getting the research and just trying to see where the problems are and how you can deal with it centrally is probably the way to go.
It's a good piece, though.
It is. Very good. Good insight. Something totally different. Kevin Sheehy.
Yes.
You had Tommy Conlon write about this.
Well, Tommy Conlon wrote something very different and tragically so. He wrote about Kevin Sheehy, who died last week. Spoke to his friend and mentor, Kevin Moore, down in St. Francis Boxing Club, down in Limerick. There's a lot to the piece. It's really well written. I think there's obviously a poignancy, obviously, about it. I think his funeral was yesterday.
Just for people who may not know who we're talking about here, this is Kevin Sheehy, who died after multiple injuries in a hit-and-run incident. There's been a man arrested, so we just have to be very careful here, because he has been charged with murder, is the latest situation. Kevin Sheehy won 5 Irish titles. He was a heavyweight boxer down in Limerick, very much focused on getting to Paris in 2024, and even had half a hope of trying to get to Tokyo next year. Boxer,
I might read
father to
first,
be.
Yeah, the first 4 paragraphs of it, it's just kind of, you know, for all that he tried to take the bright side of the road, Kevin Sheehy's life was ended on the dark side of the street, slain in an act of violence that will tremor through his family for generations. Yesterday morning in Limerick City Cemetery, his father and mother bore witness to the most dreaded of all parental terrors, standing by a graveside as their 20-year-old son was committed to the earth. Beside them, his girlfriend Emma Colbert, bearing the daughter who will be welcomed into the world next month, swaddled by love and grief, destined for a lifelong loss before she has even been born. And then it just says, close by, his friend and mentor Ken Moore of the St. Francis Boxing Club, where the coach and protege were dreaming big dreams of, and working every day to make those dreams a reality. Like, the first few paragraphs of that, as the story does, hits you right between the eyes, and you feel something within yourself when you're reading it, and you know it's a really well written piece. It's a piece obviously you would rather not have to write in, but I think Tommy Conlon's done an excellent job in bringing both giving an insight, I guess, into Kevin Sheehy and how much he meant to the people around him. But also, we were saying earlier on, myself and Jack, like how much that an insight into the area that he was in, and how much the club and the sport meant to the area.
Yeah, yeah, and it's just for me, from being from Limerick, you know, it just mentions that last Sunday he was at the Gaelic grounds to see the Limerick hurlers, you know, and then, you know, went back home, and he also, and this is kind of, I think last year the Limerick hurlers had a kind of a, you know, a kind of an amateur boxing thing that they were involved in as pre-season, and he was kind of there tangentially, but it kind of, and then suddenly he's gone, you know, and so that's, you know, that's a hugely poignant piece as well. But also then it talks about two things. He's from, you know, he's from Crewe Park in South Hill, and, you know, and all the problems that's been associated with there, and then the boxing club and what that provides, you know, and what St. Francis provides. And one of the things both of us mentioned, you know, they charge €2 for people to train, you know, and, you know, and how they help people more than the boxing itself is just a hugely, you know, important thing.
Tommy writes, boxing clubs have been a time-honoured sanctuary for working class boys and latterly girls who need to release their energy and emotion in a safe space. And St. Francis is where Kevin ended up training. Yeah. Founded in 1928, Ken Moore, you mentioned, 44 years of age, been head coach for over 10 years, has about 40 members, adult and juvenile. It costs €2 per training session. He's a volunteer. The club is run by volunteers. No coach gets paid.
Yeah. And I mean, I know people say, look, there may be better ways to help kids than boxing, for example. But boxing does a lot for kids from particular areas which are otherwise ignored by large sports and by government generally. So
why is that, Jack?
I just think it's kind of unfashionable now, you know, because of the, you know, that with the head injuries and with the innate violence of it. I'm a boxing fan, I think, you know. Mm. And I think it does great good, you know. And St. Francis is in the milk market around Limerick, and I know that the University of Limerick is moving into the city a little bit. You'd love to see someone like that help out a working class boxing club, and because it does so much that's beyond sport for Limerick itself. And, you know, in some ways the best of Limerick was represented by people like Kevin, and I think that's the important point of Tommy Collins' piece.
You can sometimes, when you read a piece like this, realise just how insulated from real money worries that most of us are lucky to be.
Absolutely.
Because Ken Moore says to Tommy Conlon here about the €2 charge per night. €2 isn't a lot of money, but it is a lot of money if you don't have it, you know. If on the night you don't have the money, it's a big thing to the kid. It's a big thing to the parents not to have the €2. They think, God.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, €2, you know, for a newspaper, you know, €2.
Coffee or anything like that.
Yeah, anything like that.
You know.
Yeah.
He says, sometimes unexpected expenses arise. Some people just don't have it.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah, and when you think that other, maybe even other sports are subsidised to such a huge level, you know. And
I was looking at the Greyhounds getting $17 million a year the other night.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's a point. Actually, Declan Lynch in the main part of the Sunday Independent mentioned that as well in a tangential way. But also what's important, they mentioned about the membership form and how they say to the kids, listen, for the year, this is discipline. Like, you are going to obey what we do. And if you do, you'll be better for it. And the kids like it,
yes,
you know, and welcome it and really buy into it. So, you know, there's a lot in that.
I think clubs were very interesting, yeah.
Yeah, I think, like, boxing clubs like that, where, you know, to get to the level that Kevin Sheehy got to requires, you know, the level of dedication, not to mind talent, but, you know, dedication, sacrifice, talent, all those things that I think are fairly unfathomable to most people. Mm. And I think, as Jack said, you know, areas such as the one that he was from are, you know, largely ignored in a lot of ways. And so the boxing clubs provide, like, that talent is there. That discipline is there in those areas, you know, in those areas of the country. It's just the outlet to actually express it often isn't there, which I think is where, you know, boxing clubs and things like that are so important, you know, that, you know, they might not have great facilities and, you know, as you said, like, areas that are largely ignored by government and by, you know, other parts of the country. But again, it just the piece itself, getting back to the piece, it just captures why kind of the club was so important to the area and why Kevin Sheehy was so important to the club.
Yeah, it really does. Like, on the importance of Sheehy to the club, having won two national under 22 championships, with his profile rising, he'd become a figurehead, says Moore. By the power of his example, he would train twice a day. He had a natural authority that comes with being a heavyweight. And he'd always go over, says Moore, to welcome any new kids who joined. A few words to them, it would mean a lot to them. And Moore talks about the loss he's going to be. On what it gives to the kids coming to the club, we don't train boys or girls here to go outside and be thugs. We train them so they don't have to go outside and feel like they have to fight. We train them to realise there's a different life if they want it. And then the point he says, which you referenced, and kids like to be held accountable. Mm. Initially they won't, but after a while they absolutely like to be held accountable. They feel more mature. We don't speak down to them, we don't bark at them, and they like that. And he talks about the level of esteem that kids get from it. So
absolutely. And
it's an amazing piece.
And it also gets across, you know, Kevin the person well as well. It mentions, you know, at one stage going to Russia on a trip, and, you know, why would you want to leave Crewe Park and Salt Hill? And then he's over in Moscow on the train then to St. Petersburg, and he comes back and says, actually, Crewe Park is very small, but he's still proud of it. You know, and I think that's a lovely way to kind of show what Tommy has done.
Yeah, it's desperately sad. Condolences to all concerned, because it really is just terrible. It's on page 5 of the Sunday Independent if you want to read it, and it's definitely recommended. We'll take a pause for a moment and go over to O'More Park. Anthony Moyles has watched the first half. What's the latest there?
Yeah, it's all square here, Joe. 1-9 to me, 12 points to Clare in a rip-roaring contest. It's great. It's actually great to be able to say that. It's been a while since I've been on a rip-roaring contest.
Considering 2 weeks ago I thought you may never watch football again.
Yeah, I was actually, I was worried for my sanity after that. No, it's brilliant. It's great. I'm looking out, loads of kids out in the pitch here. Decent crowd, massive crowd from Clare and decent crowd from Meath. On some unbelievable scores. Like, I mean, Jamie Malone, number 12 for Clare, has kicked 4 points from play, and each one has been better than the next. Like, he hit one just at the end there, outside the right boot, about easily 50 metres out, on the run, just pinged it, and has been causing problems. Meath attack hasn't really got going. They have Conlon inside, and for some reason they're not kicking the ball into him, because he has the fellas under pressure when the ball has gone into him. They got a goal. Donald Keoghan again has been really, really good coming up the pitch, but just half backs and midfielders not getting their head up early enough and hitting the full forward line. But apart from that, yeah, they've flattered to deceive, really. Lots of effort, but not enough. It's not been as slick. Clare now have hit some monster scores. Those types of scores where, you know, you just kind of go, Jesus, is it that kind of a day? Like, because they have hit some massive ones way out on near the sideline. One last one there from Malone came in, hit the post and dribbled over. Gary Brennan has been okay. Poor Akarn has actually been doing a man marking job on him and has restricted him to 1 point and has really restricted his influence very, very well. But it's a great game, I have to say. Very evenly poised. Clare had a decent breeze first half, you would say. You can't really feel it up here, but looking down on the flags, it is definitely blowing into the far end. So yeah, it's all set up.
It sounds like it. So on balance, a draw at halftime, a bit right, and this could go either way listening to you.
It could, genuinely, yeah. You know, Clare again have hit some monster scores. Probably four or five of their 12 have been ones that could have easily just went wide. You know, they haven't really got many just well worked tap overs. They've got a couple of frees, but they've four wides. I think Meath only have one or two wides.
The Clare scores might be a touch unsustainable?
Because Meath are actually doing quite well in their full back line, so they're restricting them to long range shots, which have all gone over, to be fair to them. Now, look, you know, they could keep going over, but what I'm saying is that, you know, as a defender, you're kind of saying, listen, he's taking a shot from 50 odd metres out, out near the sideline, that's going over. There's not a whole pile that can do more than that. I think the Meath full forward line, just there's been a bit of lack of work rate for me now around the Meath full forward line. Right. Clare have been coming out way too easy with the ball, and their intensity levels have to pick up there. But it's brilliantly poised. Both teams are tiring. The goal that Meath got, you could see Clare had got a great score and then just switched off, and Meath just literally just ran down the middle, popping passes overheads. Fellas just stopped chasing runners. So the bench is going going to be very, very important. And for that matter, you know, you would hope that Meath might have a little bit more on the bench. You know, they've obviously taken Graham Riley and Ben Brennan out of the starting 15 and put them on the bench. So these guys might have a point to prove when they come on.
Okay, Anthony, sit tight. Back to you across the second half. Before we get back into the papers, John Duggan standing by at Lahinch. John, we're back to the days of Seve here. Two Spaniards fighting it out.
Matadors, Joe. Matadors. Seve won it three times, the Irish Open in the 1980s. José María Lopábal has won it. Sergio García has won it. And now, Rafa Cabrera-Bello, 15 under par. And John Rahm, 14 under par. So Cabrera-Bello has been perfect on the front nine. A birdie the first, birdie the fourth with mid-range putts. Nearly aced the Dell hole. You know, Joe, from being here earlier in the week, that's the hole where it's a blind shot off the tee. Nearly went in for a hole in one, birdie that. Has missed a putt there in nine to go to 16 under, but remains 15 under. John Rahm, though, he's so exciting to watch. He is something else to watch, John Rahm playing golf. Birdied 2, 5, 7, 9. I watched his putt on the 10th, and it just accelerated right into the center of the cup. Putting with such confidence, a 64 yesterday from John Rahm. Then on the 12th, 577-yard par 5, his brute strength getting him there in 2, edge of the green, 30 feet, bang, into the cup. John Rahm, 14 under par, winner 2 years ago, of course, of the Irish Open, really in form, and he's making a massive charge here in the final round and making it exciting at Lahinch. So Rahm is 14, Robert Rock, the overnight leader, 13 under par, even par for his round today, been out of position a few times. Then Xander Lombard, 12 under, Cormac Sharvin, mixed bag for him today, back to 8 under par, 2 bogeys early, then 3 birdies in a row, then another 2 bogeys. Robin Dawson back to 6 under after 12, Joe.
Right. Jeez, John Rahm. Phenomenal. He's on course for the round of the day, that's for sure. He's, I guess, the more experienced winner in the field, and he won't let up, that's for sure.
Well, he finished really well yesterday as well. He came back in, I think, 30 shots yesterday, John Rahm. So he is, like, the way he won at Port Stewart would suggest to me that he's almost the favourite now. Cabrera-Bello was tentative over that putt at 9, and Cabrera-Bello hasn't won that much. He did win the Scottish Open a couple of years ago, but he's only won 3 times in the European Tour, and John Rahm has just got that. He can play any shot, John Rahm, when he's on. And like, I think he struggled a little bit in the rain early yesterday, but once it got sunny and calm, he really took the back nine apart yesterday, and he's threatening to do that again. And I can't really see Rock doing it today. I can't see Lombard, Campillo, Wiesberger, Pepperell. This to me is a Cabrera-Bello and Rahm shootout now for the title.
Okay, very good. Great stuff. John Duggan in Lahinch. So Cabrera-Bello on 15 under, John Rahm making a big charge, just one shot back now. Rahm is on the 13th as we speak. We'll take a short break. We're back with more from the papers.
Off the Ball on News Talk.
Brought to you by Avantcard Reward Plus Credit Card. Powered by MasterCard. Straight up better than your current credit card. Avantcard DAC is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland.
Welcome back. So Clare and Meath are level at halftime in the football, if you're just tuning in. And Rafa Cabrera-Bello leads John Rahm by one shot at the Irish Open. John Rahm, 6 under through 12 holes, has got to 14 under. Cabrera-Bello is on 15 under. We're reviewing the Sunday papers. We have Jack Anderson in studio, who is Professor of Sports Law at the University of Melbourne. And from The Independent, we have the Deputy Group Head of Sport, Aidan O'Hara. And we're going to the Sunday Times next. Wimbledon, page 10. And it won't surprise anyone to see that the 15-year-old Coco Gauff, I've watched her play and I'm not 100% sure on that pronunciation. Coco Gauff is on the way to global stardom, says Nick Pitt. And there are two really good pieces about Coco Gauff. Martina Navratilova's written one and Nick Pitt's written one. Nick Pitt's is actually excellent in that he's got a load of stuff on the family and her background and how she's come here. And I think what really sent a shot of electricity through the whole thing was when she was basically on the cusp of match point against Polona Hergog the other day, and she came back from what would have been a straight sets defeat facing two match points, and the crowd almost tried to rouse her, as Nick Pitt says, and he writes, maybe it was embarrassment or anger or a desire to show that after all the double faults and shots into the net she really can play. Whatever it was, she became a player transformed, one who could move and hit freely, a fighter. She had belief and once again was a queen. And it was the most extraordinary thing when she actually turned that around from match points to win, and her family going ballistic in the crowd. And you're looking at this and it's like Serena Williams is passing the mantle on. It's an extraordinary story.
Yes, yeah. It's certainly the like, it's the story of week one. Anyway, Wimbledon was, it's all anybody's talking about, the fact that she's 15. I'm not sure if it was 2004 or 2003 that she was born, but it's a terrifying thought of that the date of birth.
Where were you in 04? I was being born. Says, yes. Coco Gaff.
Yes. I can't remember what I was doing then, but it was, yeah. The Nick Pitt piece is very good in the sense that the background to it, and you know, Serena Williams, obviously the shadow of the Williams sisters, really is always cast across athletes, especially American tennis players, especially Black American tennis players. The shadow is never far away. One thing that Nick Pitt writes here is there were two critical differences in comparing the Williams family to Coco Gauff's family. There are two critical differences. First, the Williams family were not well off. Second, it was Coco who wanted to play tennis to please her father. The Williams girls at first were dragooned, not that they are complaining. Just previously, they give a little anecdote about how Coco had been watching her father cheer Serena Williams at the Australian Open in 2009 and kind of just said, you know, I want to do the same thing. So,
Daddy, do you like that? And
yeah.
Then she said, well, I want to do the same thing. Geez, talk about, you know, the 20 by 20 campaign and the whole, if she doesn't see it, she can't be it tagline.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
All of these taglines can have a stench of marketing and seem a bit trite.
Mm-hmm.
But if ever there was a linear story there, it's literally Coco Gauff and her father watching Serena Williams and then her saying, well, I'd quite like to do that.
Yeah.
And what, 10 years later?
Yeah.
Here we are. She beats her sister in round one of Wimbledon.
Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely. The interesting thing about it is she's 15, isn't she? 15.
Yes.
And, you know, women's tennis has been here before. You remember people like Jennifer Capriati and all of these, and they actually brought in rules to make sure that they weren't overexposed.
Yeah.
You know, so she's right on the cusp. There's only a certain amount of tournaments she can play. So it's a huge amount of pressure. You know, 1 week into Wimbledon, you know, suddenly post Serena, here's our new star, you know. So it's we've had it a little bit with Naomi Osaka as well, but having said that, you read Martina Navratilova, who should know one or two things about this, and she says Coco's tennis IQ, it's not just her physical ability, her tennis IQ is excellent.
She says off the charts.
Yeah, I mean that's
the phrase she used for her tennis IQ.
Yeah, and that's as good as you get, you know.
She elaborates on that and says the way that Coco began to change the pace of her shots, mix up the patterns of play, terrific. That tennis intelligence and the ability to figure things out when the pressure is on and you're at full tilt is partially innate.
Yeah.
Which is an interesting observation.
It is. And it's also interesting, and going back to the Nick Pitt thing as well, that if you compare to, say, someone like Naomi Osaka, who recently left her coach, and there's a complex family background there with her. I think her dad is Haitian and her mom's Japanese, but she's actually really American. She's lived.
Yeah.
But you compare to, you know, the family behind Coco's family, her dad was an ex-college basketballer, her mom... I think her mom...
Heptathlete.
Yeah, heptathlete as well.
Florida State.
And even her dad was a kind of a fairly senior business executive as well. And both of them are behind her in terms, you know, there's a huge support.
It's interesting because they cut on the BBC to the shots of her dad's sports bar, where everybody was obviously cheering on the victory. And you thought, well, that's his deal.
Mm.
And you read Nick Pitt's piece today. So he was in Georgia State. He quit when he realised she was pretty good and she was still young. I mean, she's still young now. But when she was still young, he quit his well-paid post as head of sales for a pharmaceutical company to train Coco full-time. When she was 8, she showed real promise. And the dad says, I left corporate America, just focused on getting her on her way. They moved to Florida because that's where tennis champions go. And her mother basically homeschooled her as well, which was the amazing thing. Her mother went to Florida State, was a heptathlete, and... quite extraordinary story.
Yeah, it's an extraordinary background to it, you know, and the success she's had so young.
You're worried for her. That's what you want to get out here. You're dancing around that. I'm very worried for this person.
Well, it's always the next Serena, you know, and sports often go through this, you know, and tennis is a pretty unforgiving type of game, you know, and women's tennis is quite competitive now. They're probably looking for a star, you know, and now it's latched on to Coco. But
well, they're desperate. How many tennis players can female tennis players can the casual sports fan name in the top 10.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things about Melbourne is the Australian Open is there, and we went to the first week and got a ground pass. And I'm fairly well up to date with sport, but in terms of female tennis players, I did, I wasn't that aware, yeah. You know, and that's, so that's the casual observer as well. So this is part of the package as well. It's just, and you know, you see quotes like John McEnroe saying, you know, I'll be amazed if she's not world number one before the age of 20.
Yeah, I saw that.
Wow.
Martina Navratilova, and you know, next year could be another matter, and it should not be too long before we are claiming Goff as a Grand Slam champion. Another reference is close to the finished article. The subhead of Navratilova's piece: at 15, Coco is a more complete player than most on the women's tour. Now, it's week one of Wimbledon. Like she has been absolutely the story of week one of Wimbledon. She was too much points down in her second match, so like she was within, you know, a good serve of losing that match. Now, it's absolutely fantastic for her. Her story is brilliant. Her background is brilliant. She seems to have a very solid background. Mm. But there's an enormous amount of pressure coming on this on her, because as well, going back to the Nick Pitt piece, if you almost marry the two together, where Martina Navratilova is talking about, it should not be too long before we are claiming Goff as a Grand Slam champion. As Jack said earlier on, they have these things within the Women's Tennis Association whereby they can only play 10 WTA events between her 15th and 16th birthday, then 12 and 16 in the next 2 years. Mm. It says unless their results are changed and there have been calls for review, she will not enjoy full professional eligibility until she is 18. Mm. I'm not sure when she's 16, but over 2 years before she will be fully professional. So where she goes and how she develops in those next 2 years is going to be very, very interesting to see. Mm. And also, I mean, she plays Simona Halep tomorrow, who... The crowd will obviously be on Goff's side. That's going to be a
and
huge
just
thing.
So Navratilova can't be accused of getting ahead of herself. She tips Halep to win tomorrow.
Yes. Oh, she does, absolutely. Yeah,
Halep's
yeah.
The better player.
Yeah.
She'll have more trouble with Halep's ground strokes. They're far more accurate. They're deeper. So she actually says, as good as Coco Gauff is going to be, Halep is going to beat her tomorrow.
Yeah.
So I thought that was quite a measured view. And at 15, think how much you're going to develop over the next 18 months.
Absolutely.
Two years.
Yes. But you're developing into, like, I mean, you're going into Swim with the Sharks very, very soon. You know, when you like Simona Halep, you talk about the players that we, you know, a lot of people can't really name.
Halep
would be one of them. You know, there's Kvitova. There are a lot of players out there. The quality, I would say, of women's tennis isn't as good as it was when, you know, Serena was in her pomp. But the depth of it is possibly stronger, and that's the environment in which she's going into.
Yeah, it sounds. I mean, Navratilova's piece wouldn't be the worst one for Coco to read herself, because she just lists out a few things. There are a few technical things to change. Her forehand can get a bit short and high, presenting a sitter to her opponent. She could hit the ball with more spin and pace on both wings. Her serve could be improved by using more spin, especially slice. She's good volley, but could use a bit more, especially when opponents are slicing from the back of the court, as Hergog did on Friday. So, to the point.
Yeah,
to very the good constructive criticism.
Yeah,
she does add these are minor fixes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I mean, it's good analysis. But then you think last year she won the girls' singles at the French Open at 14.
Yeah,
you know, so
yeah,
she's got insane time.
Mm-hmm. She does. Yeah, I think she'll be all right. Her mum, by the way, has a good quote. She's definitely a teenager. If people only knew how immature she is back at home.
Yeah.
Which is true of any kind of 15-year-old.
Absolutely.
Coco's bedroom, her mother confirms, is untidy. On the wall is a poster of Serena Williams.
Yeah.
So it's a surreal story, isn't it?
Yeah absolutely.
That's on page 10 of the Sunday Times. She's definitely been the story of week one. Women's World Cup, a few different pieces here.
Yeah, Amy Lawrence is a piece in the Observer. It's also in the Sunday Independent, talking about her first experience of Women's World Cup.
Just how far it's come, really.
Where
she got, it seems, Amy Lawrence in her first year as a journalist in 1995, and had not been following the women's game, got roped into doing co-commentary on the Women's World Cup final for all of Europe on Eurosport.
Yeah.
That's how under-resourced the media was around the game
back
then.
And also there can be a tendency, and it's still there, I think, with female sports, female sports journalists, to kind of pigeonhole them into female sports.
Yeah.
Which, as Amy Lawrence kind of writes, that she didn't really have a great deal of interest in the Women's World Cup, but it's the sort of thing that you can't turn down, obviously, but it's kind of shows how far it's come. You know, where she talks, she did the commentary with again showing my age, Stato from Fantasy Football League, who was Angus Loughran, who I think he was on BBC Racing, and so I'm not sure what he's up to now, but that he'd been best known as that. But the Cupboard Cum Studio was Teachy and Boiling. The monitor delivered the live feed was Diddy, best of the lot. We didn't have a pre-match team sheet, so come kickoff, did not even have the list of the names and numbers of the players we were not particularly familiar with. Now, I wouldn't do live radio or TV very often, Joe, but I'd say that'd be pretty much a worse nightmare to not have that sort of thing available in front of you.
In the pre-internet age as well.
Yes, yeah.
And then you contrast it with the semi-final between England and the US. Highest viewing figures for any programme so far this year in Britain. 11.7 million viewers. That's more than 50% of the national audience. I mean, it's huge. And even, you know, in Ireland, the game averaged 220,000, 20% share. I mean, it's just incredible growth in the game. And it'll be reflected in today's final, where a lot of the commentary is about the US team.
Just as an aside, there's a great contrast at the moment with the women's football in England and the men's cricket team who are in the World Cup semi-final. The one there is of a tournament been hosted in England, but it's on Sky. And people don't know, you know, they know what's happening. It's a big enough deal, but we're not on the BBC, you know, you wouldn't be able to move for cricket coverage across titles in the UK, even with Wimbledon and the Women's World Cup. It'd be an enormous deal.
There's no comparison.
No.
Amy Lawrence in The Observer and in the Sunday Independent writes about the 95 Women's World Cup. It was meant to be on in Bulgaria. That fell through last minute and Sweden had to step in. She says that just for a bit of perspective, consider that only 2,286 people showed up for Brazil's first match, which, she adds, dwarfs the 665 in the audience for England's opener, which puts the 250 in attendance for Nigeria's introductory appearance into the shade. 12 teams participated in all. No comparison now.
Absolutely no comparison. I suppose the common thread is the US still dominates.
Yeah.
You know, that's interesting. It probably goes back to the fact that they, at college level, they have various laws which help equality for women's sport, that they invest as much, and that's fed into that. But and there's a few pieces about the US women's team today.
Glenn Moore in the Sunday Times and Eamon Sweeney in the Sunday Independent. Not so sure they like this US women's team.
No. The headline in the Glenn Moore piece, I think it's something like hard to beat, tough to like, or something like that. And the brashness of them, they make no apology for their brashness. That's what they do. Like, they're there to win matches. I don't think they care a great deal what other people think of them. But
Eamon Sweeney talks about American self-obsession and is thankful that the US don't really participate really in international sports all that often, because we'd be stuck with this kind of business.
Yeah, and there's the inevitable reference then to Trump as well and the Twitter spat with the various US players as well. But I don't think they care, you know, and we've had that kind of thing about the tea-sipping celebration as well.
I was down in the Hinge. What was the issue with this? I didn't get this. Because I saw someone on my Twitter feed pop up as if to say, they know we like our tea. And so it was a bit as if like, oh, well, look, you can slag us about a lot of things, but you can't slag us about liking tea.
I think it's the history with the Boston Tea Party and all that kind of stuff and American independence and all that. So it's actually quite a funny, you know.
That's quite clever then, though.
It's a clever one. And I don't think, you know, and I think the Women's World Cup has so many good stories. And even the VAR debates have been interesting within that context.
Thing was like a manufacturer controversy. Nobody was outraged over the tea.
No, I think people were confused by it in as much as they wanted to know what the celebration was about, and then I think possibly got, you know, 2 and 2 plus equals 6, and I think Alex Morgan came out and explained what it was about, and it was, I can't really remember what she said, what it was about, and then she kind of gave out with a comparison with the men's, who, I think the quote was, who grabbed their sacks in celebration, which was, didn't quite get what the point she was trying to make, because if you were doing that, you would be booked for it and you'd be punished for it, and there would be a similar controversy.
Like, not everything is a double standard.
No, absolutely not.
You know what I mean?
Absolutely not.
You can revert too quickly to that, and it's not allowed to say, that was a weird celebration. What was that about?
It's not because
you're a woman.
No.
It's a weird celebration.
Yeah.
But I don't think anybody was outraged by the same token.
No, it just became one of those things that
she's slagging us over our team.
Yeah. And in the same way as the Megan Rapinoe Trump thing, if the US do win this, the next thing is going to be, will they go to the White House? How many will go to the White House? Who will go to the White House? Like, they're a superb team. The game against England was an outstanding game of football.
I have seen interesting quotes that, ironically, they're one of the least diverse teams in American sports.
I haven't kind of followed that up, you know, I think so. And that's interesting. But it's also interesting, the Dutch are interesting as well. I think they won Euro 2017.
They did, yeah.
So, and the last game they played, there was about a 5 million viewership, which is only just beaten by the Ajax Tottenham second leg.
Glenn Moore has this in the Times. Back home, TV audiences, this is in Holland, 5 million watched the semi-final despite the 9 o'clock kickoff in a country of 7.3 million. This has been exceeded for a sports event this year only by the 5.4 million who saw Ajax Tottenham second leg in the Champions League. So 400,000 difference between Ajax Spurs and the Dutch in the semi-final.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it just shows for women's sport generally why it's important. I suppose, look,
I think it is a triumph of free-to-air as well, though.
Yes. Totally.
Do you know what I mean? I've no doubt this has been a watershed moment for the women's game.
Yeah.
But I also think it does hold up free-to-air sport in comparison. If this Women's World Cup was behind a paywall in most countries, it wouldn't be getting these audiences.
No, absolutely not. And with the cricket, I think Sky have said that if England get to the final, which is probably unlikely, given they're playing the Australians, they will show it
free-to-air.
It'll be interesting to see the viewership on that.
But last year...
I was just going to say briefly, a Six Nations game, like 8, 9, 10 million BBC One in the UK, the Lions games were...
Yeah.
300,000-400,000
Yeah.
I think last year when Ben Stokes had the England cricketer, there was a trial. He was up for, I think it was assault or something wasn't it? And one of the concerns they had was around jury selection, because obviously him being supposedly a very well-known figure, and that really wasn't an issue at all. And Ben Stokes is one of the best players in the world. Mm. Yeah. There's people in England don't really know who Joe Root is, who's England cricket captain. You know, lads who have won Ashes, who in the past... everyone knows who Ian Botham is because of his exploits in the Ashes. There's lads who won captain teams to 2 and 3 Ashes, but you know, in the last 15 years since 2005, and people in Britain don't know who they are. It's incredible. It's a great study in some ways that the ECB in England got more money from Sky, but the exposure that they lost is really highlighted by the Women's World Cup as a niche sport that can be extremely popular once people can see it.
Golf has shot itself in the foot by giving away the majors as well, including the Open to Sky, which was just a bad idea.
Yeah.
Glenn Moore definitely, he talked about the 13-0 thrashing of Thailand, the celebrations, the tea celebration, whatever the upset caused by that is. He definitely mentions Ali Krieger's claim that the US squad was so good that they had the two best teams at the World Cup as a real sign of most neutrals saying, okay, I actually do want to see all you knocked off your pedestal.
Yeah, but of course it's the American mentality where, that it's that kind of positive affirmation that they are, better than anyone else. Mm. That's, and it grates with, say, certainly in Ireland it would grate and with the UK, but they don't care, and their record in the World Cup proves that they are the best.
Yeah.
There's nobody going to be coming out and saying, they gave us a good, Thailand gave us a difficult first half and, that kind of thing. There's not going to be any of that. That kind
listing off all the Thailand players.
We have to be better the next day.
We'll go to John Duggan in a minute if he's standing by, because John Rahm has taken the lead at the Dubai Duty Free Irish Open. That's very impressive stuff. He's stayed at 14 under. Cabrera Bayo, feeling the pressure somewhat, has dropped back 1 under for his round, so 13 under overall. So John Rahm is leading the Irish Open as things stand by a shot. On the golfing front, there are a few pieces, as you might imagine. Dermot Leese has spoken to pretty much the best golf coach in the world right now, Pete Cowan, who was in La Hinch, and it's a good chat. There's Wilmer Erskine, who is the boss at Portrush, literally called the boss, courtesy of Darren Clark, and she's been down in La Hinch this week looking at how they're doing things, but really talking about the transformation in Portrush as a town and as a golf course over the last 30 years. And then there's Paul Kimmage following Matt Wallace and his long-suffering caddy.
Yeah.
So these are the three pieces that kind of jumped out at us from the golf. They're all very good in different ways.
Yeah. There's a couple of pieces in the Mail as well. Philip Quinn talks about the round that he played in La Hinch as well, which is, for the Sunday papers, it can be quite difficult when you just gave a live update of the score. So to make sure that if people are still picking up their papers, that their golf stuff isn't out of date. There's a report from yesterday, but there's other stories that are still interesting on Sunday evening or on Monday and that kind of thing. And Paul Kimmage's piece around the caddy is good. I mean, there's a bit of Matt Wallace's caddy, I should say.
Dave McNeely.
Dave McNeely, yeah. Now, I wasn't particularly aware of this before I read that piece.
Oh, were you not?
No, okay, no, I have to say. I obviously knew who Matt Wallace was, but I didn't know his, what appears to be his very large reputation for, you know, chewing out the caddies that he has.
If you go onto the internet after this, Matt Wallace has come on the scene lately.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He loses the plot at his caddy, and he will shout at his caddy, and he'll do it on camera.
Yeah.
And Dave McNeely has been on the scene a long time, has caddied for Padraig Harrington, has caddied for various people at 67, says Kimmage. Yeah. He's the oldest, most loved and unluckiest bagman on tour. He spent 3 years with Nick Faldo before the Englishman's triumph at Muirfield, 6 years with Nick Price before he won a Turnberry, 5 years with Harrington before he won a Carnoustie, and he declined John Daly's invitation a week before his win at St Andrews. So he's never quite won a major. He says, I'm going to write a book, How I Caddied the Winners of 14 Majors, None of Them With Me. Yeah, so he's a sense of humour about it all.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And he's taken on this young, angry young man, Wallace, is kind of the theme of Kimmage's piece. And I was up there, and any time I was anywhere near the Matt Wallace group, Kimmage was lurking, pen and paper in hand, watching them, watching the rounds in full. Yeah.
And I think there's an understanding within the industry, if you like, that, you know, golfers are going to vent every now and then, and that the caddy is the nearest person.
It's the verbal punchbag.
Yeah, but the point about this is, and, you know, there's lots of people within the piece saying that the European Tour needs to take a look at this, you know, and actually I think Paul Kimmage asked the European Tour what's their stance on bullying in the workplace, and they said, you know, they gave him the usual code of conduct stuff, and then they say, but by the way, that doesn't apply to players and caddies because they're independent contractors, which is an interesting thing for caddies, you know, and just shows you the kind of position they're in. They get on to the European Tour Caddies Association as well, and they kind of give the line, you're entitled to an environment that's free from discrimination or intimidation, but they can just contact the European Tour again. So it goes around in a circle. So it's an interesting piece on this, where it's a pretty precarious position, a caddy.
It's awful. You can be fired at any moment.
Yeah.
So there's no...
Literally.
So where are the, you know, kind of union or legal kind of issues for them, or do they just have to accept that?
I think it's just accepted. So, like, can we just talk to different people? Here's a caddy who played with them 2 years ago, is what he writes. And the quote is, it was the first time I played with Wallace. We had gone about six holes, and I said to Dave, this is Wallace's caddy, this guy's a... bleep, but it's an area unique to the male gender. And then he talks about another caddy who remembered Wallace shouting, not for Dave's benefit, but for the benefit of the crowd, you're the worst effing caddy out here. Mm-hmm. This is a 67-year-old man who's played with major champions, and Wallace is screaming at him, you're the worst caddy out here. And one former player says they need to ban him for 3 months. They won't, though, because they're afraid he'll go to the US. And another caddy says... So Kimmage has gone around and talked to lots of people, which is good here.
Yeah.
Another caddy says, no comment. I said what I had to say to Wallace 2 weeks ago, which would have been a good conversation to hear more about.
Yeah, I mean, he does seem to be aware of it.
Yeah, that's the
Wallace,
whole point.
That's the thing. He seems to be, he's trying, and like his it doesn't seem like he wasn't quite the chosen one of a golfer. Obviously, it says here, you know, he left school at 18, took a job in a clothing store and accepted a golf scholarship to Jacksonville State University in Alabama, returned home, made the England amateur team, then set his sights in the pros. He was the 1,156th ranked player in the world at the start of 2016, which, you know, middle of 2019 now, and he's won, his prize money's in here somewhere. It's in the millions anyway.
Yeah.
But that he kind of hasn't had the... you know, the superstar route, if you like, to get among the elite, where you might say, you know, came up, won everything, you know, around the amateurs, went on the, was selected hugely sought after in the States, and, you know, all the, if you like, the etiquette that sometimes goes around that growing up and things like that. So, like, he seems to be fairly rough around the edges with, so maybe that's, like, that might have something to do with it, but... you know, certainly speaking to people the way he appears to speak to the caddies, it's not on, no matter what way you've been brought up. But
he says, it's something I'm working on. I'm not proud of how I dealt with that situation. This was when he was giving McNeely a real going over after a tournament they were close to winning. And I've definitely addressed it and moved on. And McNeely says, people forget 3 years ago he was playing on the Alps Tour. He's having to learn. I caddy to have fun, I caddy to win majors. And if we can push through this, we're going to be stronger. So Kimmage then concludes the piece by saying, it's Friday, they're on the 18th with Ram and Westhuizen. Wallace has the honour. He turns to McNeely, driver, McNeely says, I don't mind a 3-wood, it's just a personal preference. Wallace pulls driver, rips it down the fairway, steps back and watches Rahm. A spectator's trying to take a picture with her phone. Wallace reaches for the phone, takes the picture of Rahm, throws in a selfie before handing it back. He is charm personified. He has behaved impeccably for 2 days and is playing brilliant golf. Let's hope it lasts.
Yeah.
I think one of the keys to those last two paragraphs is rips it down the fairway.
Yeah.
You know, had he taken the driver out and, you know, sliced it off four right and has to put the, you know, has to give it back to McNeely, who's knowingly looking at the 3-wood.
I didn't follow every hole, but I was very curious to follow that group, largely because West Azen has got one of the more beautiful swings in the world. And Rahm is Rahm. But I was very much watching the McNeely-Wallace interaction.
Yeah.
It was no different than every player in caddy. It was absolutely fine for those few days.
Yeah.
But when he loses his temper, he's turning to McNeely.
Okay.
Above that, I wasn't too familiar with Wilma Erskine. Bit of a legend, really. She's been secretary manager of Royal Portrush for 35 years. And this is James Corrigan in The Telegraph, and it's in the Sunday Independent.
Yeah.
So she's kind of earned the nickname The Boss. Tells a great anecdote about Rory McIlroy.
Oh, yeah.
Isn't this good stuff?
Yeah.
As a couple of years ago, my assistant kept telling me, there's this chap who keeps ringing, asking for you to fix up a tea time. Eventually, he caught me when I was in the office. The voice said, hi, Wilma, it's Rory. Is it okay if I come and play the course? I replied, Rory, you're an honorary member. You're a 4-time major champion. You're the course record holder. You really don't have to ask permission. Rory says, but I remember once you told me to always be courteous when I wanted to play any course, to always ring ahead. She said, yes, but you were 14 at the time.
Fantastic.
It reflects very well in McIlroy, actually, I have to say.
It does, it does. And
but she's talking really, Jack, about the change at Portrush from the 1980s through to now.
Yeah. I mean, first of all, it's great for Northern Ireland that the Open is returning to Portrush since, 1951 or sometime like that. I'm staying up in Belfast at the minute, you know, and they're really promoting that. That and the Game of Thrones. What more do you want on a weekend? You know, golf and the Game of Thrones. So it's tremendous. But she speaks about, you know, Portrush is now high up on every golfer's bucket list.
Yes.
She looked at the diary in 1985 and there was one American 3-ball who played in the whole year. We were so excited, we put a big circle around it and marked it USA.
Isn't it amazing?
And it's absolutely amazing. And now it's booked out and you have to go years and months.
She said now when they ring, they don't ask what month can they get out, it's what year, the Americans.
Yeah, and it's fantastic for Northern Ireland. It's fantastic for Portrush and it's a fantastic golf course as well. So hopefully, you know, this Open can be, you know, promoted even more because it's a great golfing destination.
This orange parade nonsense on the Saturday night can go and jump as well. Yeah. We took about 36 grand in green fees that year in the 80s when the Americans came. Last year we took 2.2 million with a 5 million turnover. So it really is amazing. I remember even driving up there in 2012. There was like, I think it might have been like the Stephen Nolan show or something.
Yeah. Mm.
And very famously, and it's on the BBC website, in 2011, a Dutch tourist had called Portrush the Beirut of Northern Ireland because it just needed a lick of paint and needed to be brought up to speed.
Yeah.
And they put 17 million into the town just this year for this tournament.
Yeah.
So it's thriving. It's an amazing story. And look, it doesn't happen without the peace process. That's the truth.
No, it doesn't.
No, she references that as well. Mm-hmm. Actually,
we were just hoping that the legacy of it will, you know, benefit all of the golf courses around Northern Ireland, of which there are many and great ones. So
Port Stewart down the road is outrageous. Yeah.
Royal County Down.
I know our racing industry is right up there, but we may be the world leaders in golf courses.
It's incredible. You know,
space.
Land in any airport and drive kind of 40 or 50 miles in any direction, you're going to find some astonishing golf courses.
Yeah. The Pete Cowan interview, clock's getting against us, is well worth a read with Dermot Gleese. He's kind of the best coach in the world now. Basically, he's had 10 major winners in the last 9 years. Like, Pete Cowan was watching the US Open with Gary Woodland beating Brooks Koepka, and he coaches both of them. You know, this guy is just the business. I love Irish players, he says to Dermot Gleese, because they're individuals. Everybody comes to golf having learned the game in a different way in Ireland. Perhaps by observation or another sport, they pick up what they like and they make it work. Talks about Clark being the most talented of the older generation.
Mm. Yeah, and a classic kind of a coach. He was a pro himself.
Yeah.
Not a great pro, but still a pro himself. And they sometimes make the best coaches because they know their own limitations and yet can pass it on to the others. So I think that's a really interesting piece.
Yeah,
He talks about learning as well. The price that he paid. I think it's in the pull quote there. The amount of money he paid. You know, $200 for 10 lessons. You know, in the space of a few weeks, and basically, you know, you have to pay to learn. I think is the line in the piece that,
you know, that he amount of money and time, etc., that he's invested, and how it's paying off for him.
1978, he paid $200 an hour for lessons, $2,000 for 10 lessons over 2 weeks to learn. Yeah. The tutor was Gardner Dickinson, who was Ben Hogan's guy. Which is kind of a legendary place to learn. It says, of the more mature players, so he rates Clark as probably the most naturally talented. It says of Christy O'Connor, he played with O'Connor when he was on tour. Saturday morning arrived, first tee, he was a bit rough around the edges. First drive, a drivable par four, he topped his drive no further than the ladies' tee. Without blinking an eyelid, he simply walked forward, driver still in hand, proceeded to swish the ball off the deck onto the green. I will never forget it. Which sounds outrageous. McIlroy, the most talented hand-eye coordinated player you'll ever see, he says. Greater emphasis on technique would bring greater consistency, but he says that would take away something.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting. Yeah.
Isn't it interesting? Yeah, yeah. That would diminish the talent if he got too technical.
Exactly. So when he's going to win big. Yeah. Because that's just the way he plays.
Yeah.
You know, so it's a real coach mentality. How much do you interfere with or just back off?
Yeah, it's a sign of a good coach then, like, as well, that you recognise that and don't try, because you've seen golfers in particular over the years who start tweaking with things and lose what got them there in the first place.
Totally. I was listening to him being interviewed in Five Live recently, and I think he made the point that one of the greatest pieces of coaching in golf history is Jim Furyk's dad.
Just going to say,
Yeah.
Who was a golf pro himself.
Yeah.
And looked at his son with this horror show of a backswing.
Yeah.
But understood.
Yeah.
Just consistently doing
just leave it.
And when you go back, just going back to Wimbledon and Coco Gauff and all that sort of stuff, that, you know, what the next step is on the coaching process of these things, where, you know, Martina Navratilova has recognised all these different things, but what does her coach, you know, what's the next step for her coach to get her to the next level, because these things all come, you know, her natural talent, the brain that she has, allied to the technical stuff, to the mentality and all that, and the challenges you face,
like,
with that.
How quickly would you say to Coco Gauff, we need to fix all of this now?
Yeah.
Or how quickly would you say, well, I'm not going to tell her about the other stuff that's wrong with her game, because I don't want to ruin her confidence. We're going to do it slowly but surely.
Slowly,
There's such an art to it.
And you can see golfers that they overanalyze and can't get it back.
So much time to think.
Yeah. So that's an important point. Yeah.
As we begin to wrap up, Jack and Aidan, are there any pieces you want to just point people in the direction of that might be worth a look?
Yeah, so the Sunday Independent has a good kind of almost a section on cricket. There's a Lord's Test coming up between Ireland and England, so some fantastic pieces in that, which kind of gives a sense of where cricket is at now in Ireland, and also a great piece by Eamon Sweeney looking back on the West Indies visiting in the, I think it's the mid-1980s. The only other piece that I picked up was just two brief pieces in the Sunday Times, one on Mo Johnson signing for Rangers 30 years ago, the first Catholic to sign. It's by Graeme Souness himself, who's manager, and he talks about Mark Walters was the first black player, Mo Johnson was the first Catholic player. Mm. He said did it for footballing reasons, and also a nice mention that Ray Houghton was, I think Ray Houghton must have been at Oxford at that stage, and instead of going to Liverpool he could have gone to Rangers, but there was a period of reflection and
he talked to some family and advisors
and friends, and that didn't happen. So that's an interesting piece, and right beside that there's a piece on referees in England and how black and ethnic minorities are not represented as referees at all. And one amazing stat for me, in the 27-year history of the Champions League, there's never been a black referee.
Is that right?
Yeah, that's one of the and I thought that was an interesting piece on that. Wow. So just
more than just a statistical anomaly, isn't it?
Absolutely, we talk a lot about coaches, you know, in England, and black and ethnic minority coaches and how that's been impacted. But here's another
area of the game
that is not being looked at.
You wanted to mention the Hendersons?
Yeah, the Hendersons, there's a League of Ireland piece by David Kelly in the Sunday Independent again, that Dave and Stephen Henderson and their mother, who I think is 81, fantastic picture by Mark Condren, taken at the house in Dublin there last week. Basically, you know, their father was a goalkeeper, they've sort of a lineage within the League of Ireland, stretching back 60 or 70 years. There's three sons, I think, if I get it right, you know, off the top of my head, I think there's three sons who are goalkeepers. Mm. Another son then from there, Stephen Jr., who I think is still playing. I think he might have got a new deal with a Premier League club just recently. Wayne also, who was an Irish international, and Stephen and David, who they both have plenty to say about the state of the game, their own, you know, history and stuff like that. It's kind of a quirky piece. It's the sort of piece that you'd kind of stumble upon, and I think with the picture that's there, you might go into it. Going back to the GAA, we were saying before about the things you can push on the calendar. Mm. Michael Clifford has a column around the putting foul play in the sin bin and hurling, and then the back pass rule, that he's actually in favour of it. I know Eamon Sweeney has a piece saying he's not in favour, he thinks it's ridiculous, but the Michael Clifford's piece is should be a no-brainer, that it'll reward, it'll create better spectacle. And then there's another piece of Shane McGrath there talking about the GAA's half-cocked ideas simply must be resisted. So even within, you know, getting to the business end of the Super 8s and the hurling and all that in the GAA, they're still talking about ideas and rules and
structures.
Money and structures and, you know, tiers and all sorts of stuff like that. It's the beast of the GAA at this time of year you can never get enough of it, really.
No. Gents, thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you.
Much appreciated. On the papers today again, Jack Anderson, Professor of Sports Law at the University of Melbourne, and Aidan O'Hara, Deputy Group Head of Sport with The Independent.
The Sunday Papers on Off the Ball.
Brought to you by Avantcard Reward Plus Credit Card. Powered by MasterCard. Straight up better than your current credit card. Avantcard DAC is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland.